ourselves comfortable in an upright and alert posture. And you might take a moment to discern, now that we're sitting here in meditation posture, do you have an expectation? Does this imply that you have to do something that you're going to meditate? That you have to change something? If mindfulness is simply to be aware of what's happening now, what's happening for you right now? What's predominant for you? A metaphor for meditation, perhaps, or mindfulness, could be, it's like lowering yourself into the ocean and then surrendering to the water so the water can hold you up. So we lower ourselves into our present experience and then surrender into whatever is happening. And we discover it can hold ourselves up. So allowing all things to be as they are, take a couple of deep breaths, and then as you breathe out, settle into your body, surrender into your body. And then breathing normally. Feel what your body is like right now. What is the predominant experience of being in a body? Of inhabiting a body. And then within the body, as part of the body, let yourself become aware of how the body experiences your breathing. Let your body surrender to the breathing. Let your awareness rest in the breathing. Not trying to change who you are or change what's happening, just in the midst of whatever is happening, feeling the in-breath and feeling the out-breath, the expansion and contraction. simply appreciating what it's like to be conscious. Appreciating what it's like to be conscious through breathing consciously. Whenever the mind wanders away, and gently and softly open your awareness again so it receives the breath, the breathing, breathing consciously. Having an experience of yourself that is not mediated by the incessant thinking mind. Having a direct personal experience of your body breathing. opening your awareness to receive the breath or whatever is predominant, as if your whole body was the field of awareness. Opening the field of your body to be aware of what's predominant. If something is occurring that makes it difficult for you to stay in the present moment, to stay conscious, identify what that is. And identifying it, having identified it, then feel it very simply as an event in the body, the emotionality of it, the energetics of it. So that you become present mindfully, consciously, of that which is making it difficult for you to be present. And if it's not an issue, then let yourself rest with the in-breaths, rest with the out-breaths, rest with the rhythm of your breathing. And as you sit there trying to be conscious and aware, take a moment now to reflect and explore what is the primary relationship that you have going on right now. Are you at ease? Do you have aversion to something? Do you have desire for something? Is there a relationship of openness or a relationship of pushing something away or holding on to something? In the same open way that you're aware of the breath, become aware of your relationship. Maybe it's your relationship to meditation itself. You're sitting with expectation, with hope, with striving, with judgment, with disappointment or frustration. Simply be aware. And then when you hold the things in the field of awareness, what happens to them? Letting the mind be like a mirror, simply reflecting what's happening. And then in a few moments, I'm going to ring the bell to end the sitting. And I'm going to ring the bell 3 times. And as you hear the sound, open your awareness to receive the sounds of the ringing. And then after the 3rd ring, bring your awareness to your area of your eyes. And then when you're ready, open your eyes and let seeing happen by itself. Allow sight objects to come to you, mindfully being aware of what you see. It's an interesting exercise to try to continue the mindfulness for a few moments or minute at the end of a sitting, so that you extend it into your listening and your hearing. A lot of people, when the bell rings to end a sitting, they kind of think, well, it's time to stop, or they give up, or it's vacation time, or whatever. And what that means is that the usual habits of mind just kind of storm right back in. But if you can allow in a simple, gentle way to let the mindfulness continue a little bit beyond the ringing of the bell or the ending of your sitting, you might become aware of some of the habits that are unnecessary in your life, but which are kind of on automatic. And one of the interesting ones, maybe it's kind of subtle to see or to perceive, is with seeing itself, is that there's a lot of our relationship to the world is reflected in how some of us use our eyes. And there's a difference between kind of allowing things just to come to you through the eyes in a kind of gentle way, or kind of, in a sense, letting the eyes kind of go out and reach and grab for things, to want things and make things into objects. I don't know if this is a problem more acute for people with glasses, but anyway. And it's interesting just to see that, to see what goes with that and this switch that might happen. It's said in Buddhism that a lot of the wisdom that can come from a meditation practice doesn't only come from the meditation practice itself, but comes from the transition from going from meditation back to our regular life. Whether it's on a retreat where we sit for a day or for a week or whatever, or whether just a single period of sitting, the transition back into our normal life, if you pay attention there, if you continue your mindfulness during that time, there's the opportunity there to start seeing how we reconstruct ourselves in our reality. What happens to some degree in meditation is that the mind quiets down, usually a little bit, and the usual thought constructs by which we live our life, by the way we see ourselves and construct a sense of self, the way we construct a sense of reality and what has to be done and what should be done and all this, all these settle down to some degree. The opportunity at the end of a sitting is to pay attention to how we reconstruct those, how we make a self out of it again, how we make a kind of self that needs to be a certain way, or how certain fears or certain expectations or desires or whatever. And it's said there's a lot of wisdom, a lot of self-understanding, a lot of freedom can be found in paying attention to that transition, because we can start seeing what is optional and what is not in the reconstruction. The example then from earlier was driving my car in Skyline. The anger, in a sense, was optional when I got to see the fear really clearly. It wasn't optional until I saw the fear, which is kind of happened automatically. If we can watch carefully, we can start seeing where the optionality lies in our life, where we have choice. And one of the great opportunities of getting really quiet and settled in meditation is to bring that settledness back into our life, not to hold on to it by any means, that's going to cause suffering, but to see how things change out of that, how you go back into a busy mind or hectic mind or preoccupied mind or body or whatever, to understand better what's going on. Fascinating study. I did this in the monastery with around speaking, where we had a long period of silence. And so at the end of the silence in the morning, I would have made a practice of noticing what the first speech act was of each day. And some days I wouldn't notice until the end of the day that I'd spoken all day long. But sometimes I would be there, try to be there, you know, for the first speech act, because in speaking, there's a tremendous amount of conditioning, of judgments, of ideas, evaluations, sense of self that often gets infused into any speech act because it has to do with talking with someone. If you're talking with someone, you might as well create a self to talk with them, right? And then you have to be a certain way, take a certain stance, and do this and that. And if you pay attention to the first speech act of the day or first speech act after a period of meditation, it's a really rich time to discover what I'm talking about here, the reconstruction of ourselves and our reality. Never to judge anything, just to see it better. And I feel like what I want to tell you a fairy tale. I don't know if this is a good idea, but hopefully by now you've learned how to be aware non-judgmentally. Or at least I have. Because I read this fairy tale today. So it's this king had three sons, or the queen had three daughters, whatever you want, the way you want to see it. And the king was dying, and he was very, very sick in the palace. And this old man showed up in the palace garden and said, if you can find the water of life and administer it to your father, he'll get well. And so the oldest son, who was rather greedy and ambitious, said, well, if I find the water of life, my father will be so happy with me that I will inherit the kingdom. So he dashes onto his horse and dashes out the palace and through the town. And he gets to the edge of town at the gate. There's this poor begging dwarf, ugly little runt of a dwarf, actually, or whatever, in the fairy tale. And very poor, and it looks kind of like he needs help. And he stops the prince and says, you know, stop. And this prince kind of stops his horse. And he says, and the dwarf says, well, where are you going? And the prince says, oh, I don't have time for you, and gallops off and leaves him in the dust and just gallops out into the mountains and up into the valleys and down this valley. And the valley becomes kind of like a box canyon, and he goes into the end, and then the box canyon kind of closes in on himself, and he's kind of stuck there. The second prince is also rather ambitious and greedy and also wants the kingdom for himself and thinks, well, if I find the water of life, the same thing happens. And he comes to the gate, and the dwarf is there, and he treats this dwarf the same dismissive way and doesn't even give him the time of day. And he gets stuck in some box canyon way up in the mountains. So then comes a third youngest son, the youngest prince or the youngest princess. And he goes off, gets on his horse, and says, well, I'll go look for the... He's the kind, gentle, you know. I don't know why it's always the youngest child. but anyway, you know, he's kind of the, you know, altruistic one. And he goes off, and he comes to this dwarf, and he gets off his horse, and he says, oh, is there anything I can do for you? You seem kind of hungry and poor. And the dwarf says, no, but what are you doing? And the prince says, oh, my father, the king, is sick, and we were told that if we find the water of life, we could cure him. But none of us know where it is. My brothers gallop off into the sunset, but they didn't really know where they're going. And I don't know either, but I thought I'd go out and look. And the dwarf said, oh, well, maybe I can help you. And he said, it's up there, behind that tree, you know, wherever you find it. So he went and he found it, and he brought it back to his father, and his father got well, and everyone lived happily ever after. I assume also the princes in the canyon. And what struck me about this story was it's kind of a metaphor for stopping and paying attention. I mean, the first two princes, maybe because of their ambitions and their greed, they wanted to get something. They were looking for something. But they didn't even know where it was. They had no clue. But it didn't matter. They were going to go full steam ahead and get it, not pay attention to anything. And the younger brother, he didn't know where it was either. But he at least stopped and paid attention. And stopping and paying attention and then being a little bit generous in the midst of that, on top of that, helped him find what he didn't know where it was. I thought that was a nice story for mindfulness, because mindfulness practice is, in a sense, stopping and paying attention. And in stopping and paying attention to what's going on, perhaps, if you want to, it's a great thing to do, be a little bit generous, whatever that means in a particular situation. Be generous to yourself, compassionate. So that in the fifth week now of this introductory courses, now that we've met, this is the fifth week we're meeting, and the first week we've talked about mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of the body, of emotions, and mindfulness of thoughts. And the idea being that you start getting a sense of how to include the full range of your humanity as part of the field of mindfulness, field of awareness. Not as a technique, not as something to make yourself busy with, but rather as a way of being more intimate with life, participating more fully with your experience by learning how to pay attention to it carefully as things arise. To stop and pay attention rather than barreling ahead and not noticing what's actually here. To stop and actually notice. Notice what our emotions are. Notice what they feel like in our body. Or whatever it might be. Notice what our thoughts are. Many of us don't even know what we're thinking, but, you know, they run our lives. And this fifth week, then, is more about the integration of this mindfulness into our normal life. And one of the things you might have noticed, as I've been talking about mindfulness during these 4 weeks, that I tend to kind of slip back and forth between talking about mindfulness as if I'm talking about meditation, sitting in your cushion and meditating, and talking about mindfulness as just something you do in your daily life. And maybe it confuses you sometimes because I don't seem to have any clear boundaries between when I'm talking about one and when I'm talking about the other. The opportunity with mindfulness is it's much more than just a meditation practice where you sit in meditation. Meditation is actually a very wonderful thing to do and very powerful. And there are often opportunities that exist in deep meditative experiences for understanding ourselves, understanding our world, that are unparalleled to almost anything else we can do. And it's a wonderful thing to do, to explore and deepen consciousness through meditation. But mindfulness is much more than just meditation. It's also just bringing, stopping and paying attention, learning to pay attention in our normal life. And it's a very powerful thing to do. I often feel, just in my own meditation, still after all these years, in my meditation and in my daily life, that there's something magic about mindfulness, about awareness. And I don't know if I can kind of describe what the magic is, but I suppose what the magic is that all I do is try to pay attention to what's going on. And something wonderful sometimes happens that wasn't my doing. And the fact that it wasn't my doing, but this wonderful thing happened, it seems like magic. So it happened the other day. I sat down to meditate. And I didn't want to meditate. I was kind of grouchy and kind of in a foul mood or whatever. And it felt like, you know, this, you know, I kind of thought, well, it would be nice to sit here and kind of feel better and calm out and get, you know, kind of whatever, peaceful. It would be nice to do that, but how do you start, you know? And I said, well, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to be here with what's going on. And so I noticed what my mood was a little bit and was with it for a while. And it wasn't so predominant, so I went back to my breath and just stayed with my breath for a while. At some point, I noticed that I was happy. How did it happen? You know, that it went from being grouchy to being happy. If I had listened to my little voice in my mind, the monkey mind, I wouldn't have sat there because I was a little bit restless, frustrated. What good is this? And you know, I'm grouchy anyway. I should do something else. And I would have listened to my impatience. By simply staying still in the midst of that and being aware, something starts happening, and it feels like magic. And it's a wonderful thing to live a life that's mindful, that's conscious, that's paying attention. So this person is talking about bringing mindfulness to work. At the heart of workday practice is the intention to be aware of and connected with whatever is happening inside and around us, as well as the determination to initiate change when appropriate. A wonderful example of this process is revealed in the following story told to me some years ago by a physician friend. I'd like to share it with you in the form of a story entitled Little Green Dots. My friend told me that as his practice grew busier and more demanding, he began to have minor transient symptoms that included increased neck and shoulder tension, fatigue and irritability. Initially, the symptoms were benign, disappearing after a good night's rest or a relaxing weekend. But as his medical practice continued to grow, the symptoms became persistent, and much to his chagrin, he noticed he was becoming a chronic clock watcher. One day, while attending to his normal clinical duties, he had a revelation. He walked over to his secretary's supply cabinet and pulled out a package of little green dots used for color coding the files. He placed one on his watch and decided that since he couldn't stop watching the clock, he'd use the dot as a visual cue that served as a reminder to center himself by taking one conscious breath and dropping his shoulders. The next day he placed a dot on the wall clock, for he realized, if I'm not looking at the one on my wrist, I'm looking at the one on the wall. He continued this practice, and by the end of the week had placed a green dot on each exam room door. A few weeks after initiating this workday practice, he said that, much to his surprise, he had stopped, breathed, and relaxed 100 times in a single day. This simple, persistent decision to be mindful had been transformative. He felt much better, and most importantly, his patients told him that he was much more like himself. For him, that was the icing on the cake. So to start bringing mindfulness into daily life, just simply to pay attention. And some people can just, you know, do it just on their own. Just the motivation is there, the interest is there. And there's nothing really magic about what that is. It's just paying attention to what's actually happening now. And as you do that, paying attention to whatever is predominant. If it's predominant, what's going on within you. If you're raging anger at the music, pay attention to the anger, not the music. The anger has an object. We tend to focus so much on the object, and we sometimes don't even notice what's predominant. And it might be the anger which is predominant, not the music anymore. Music started off being the predominant thing, but then it became the anger. So noticing what's predominant, being with and sensing it and feeling it, stopping. Some people use cues through their day as ways of helping them, reminding them to be mindful. It's said that mindfulness is extremely simple, easy. What's difficult is remembering to do it. So having cues. A cue that I used for a while was going through doorways. Because if you go through a doorway, it's kind of like you're going into a new space. And if you're going into a new space, you should pay attention to where you're going to go, where you did new thing. It seemed like a good place to pay attention to me. Other people will do it when the telephone rings. And rather than picking it up on the first ring, let it ring two or three times. And those two or three rings, doing what he does. You know, take one or two breaths consciously, relax your shoulders, and be present. Some people will do it driving their cars. Some people like to just be mindful driving their cars. They leave the radio off. Some people will do it at stoplights. If you have 30 seconds at a stoplight, rather than fretting, be mindful. Or there's many different areas and places one can do. One friend of mine chose a different activity to be mindful of each week so that... The first week it was light switches. Whenever she turned light switches on or off, she would pay attention to what's actually going on then, pay attention to herself and spend a few moments being mindful. The next week it was whenever she opened and closed doors. And the next week was when she washes the dishes. Next week when she was cooking the food for the meal. You know, and she just, you know, next week every time she was in the bathroom. And slowly, over the year, she more and more of her life started being included in the field, in the practice of mindfulness. And she started becoming more and more conscious and aware. This particular friend actually matured very, very deeply and eventually became a meditation teacher, primarily from this kind of mindfulness, of applying it very diligently, carefully, joyfully into her daily life. So partly it's a matter of being motivated and interested, finding that it's valuable and interesting to do this, to live with awareness, to bring as much awareness as you can. Something that I've done a lot of in bringing mindfulness to your life is to pay attention to my body, to come back to my body over and over again. What's happening in my body? I do that as much as I can, even when I give these talks sitting in front of you. I try to stop and you don't even notice that I stop perhaps, but I just kind of see, where's my body? I can see sitting here that if I'm caught in what I'm trying to say, I want to convince you, of something or whatever, that the center of gravity within me kind of begins being projected forward. Maybe even my body goes forward slightly. If I'm just kind of talking in a balanced way, then I'm balanced in my body. And if I pay attention, check into my body, I can feel the slight variation. And that checking into my body tells me a lot of information about what's going on with my mind, my attitude, my relationship to what's going on. Checking in with the body is a powerful way of bringing mindfulness into daily life. But one of the things that is probably most helpful is being aware of what your intention is. And to the degree in which this is a Buddhist practice, Buddhism is a religion that's in some sense has intention at the center of it. Not a particular intention, unless the intention is to be awakened, be awake. But it places the intention at the heart of our life, and it says you should pay very careful attention to what your intentions are. So more than just paying attention to your breath and your body and your feelings and your thoughts, we also pay attention to what is the intention, the motivation, behind our activities that we do. And that can be from the most minute activity to the most grand activities, major life decisions. What is the quality of that intention? What informs that intention? Is that intention mingled with ill will or hate? Or is it mingled with desire or ambition or craving? Or is it mingled with wisdom or generosity or joy or inspiration? What is that intention mingled with? And one of the things then to do in a mindful life is to be mindful of what is the deepest intention you have for yourself in your life. What is the thing that you most want? What is your heart's deepest wish? It's something which a lot of people maybe only ask themselves a few times in their life. But to ask yourself maybe each day, today, what's my deepest intention? What is my real priority for how I want to live my life? I think it's very easy in our culture with all the conflicting messages we get and all the seductions we get from advertisements and our culture and society, to have these very superficial intentions and desires that kind of control us, that run us, that we won't want. But to ask us, what is you really deeply want in your life? What is your heart? You can figure out for yourself, what is my experience and what can I decide? So this, I think, is a very important point about mindfulness, about Buddhism, is that you become your own authority. And maybe, to some degree, in teaching a five-week introductory course, maybe it's more theoretical because many of you maybe are just beginners. But I think the idea is that after these 5 weeks, you have 5 weeks less need for a teacher. And eventually you don't need a teacher at all, because you kind of learn the basics of how to be mindful and how to apply it to your life. Because you have to become your own authority. And how do you do that? You do that by paying attention. It's the only way you're going to do it. You're not going to do it by reading a book. You have anything you want to add or say or questions you have? I've talked for a long time. Give you a chance. Yeah.
Well, I'm really thinking about the story about the woman who was being mindful in these different places of her life. You know, she would choose them and then be mindful in that place. But one of the places I've chosen for quite a while to try and be mindful, and it's really a struggle for me, is having breakfast in the morning. It's like I want to listen to the radio and I want to read the paper and I want to have them all at the same time. And I haven't been. So my question is, I'm still in the struggling part and I want to know how to bring joy to that, you know, even if it's just for a moment.
Someone said, or actually it was an ad in a catalog that came to my house. It was a little ad, it was selling you something. And it was little signs you put on your wall that says, you know, home sweet home. And this one said, it's a blessing to be able to laugh at oneself, because then you'll never stop being amused. So you can start there. Isn't this amazing? You can actually try to do even better. Why don't you get your portable phone and try to talk at the same time? Do it really well. See how many things you can do at once. So that's a beginning. The other thing you can do is before you go to breakfast, sit down. Maybe you're sitting already if you meditate, but if you don't, sit down for a couple of minutes and see what do you really most want right then and there. You most want to do all these things at once, or is there something else which you want more? If what you really want is to do all these things at once, do them really thoroughly. Throw yourself into the activity of doing breakfast and eating and listening and papering and all those things until you get sick. Just. But if there's something which is deeper in you, that you want to be stay in touch with yourself, you want to be centered, you want to be happy, you want to remember what you read in the paper, you know, or remember what's hearing them, you know, maybe that deeper desire, you can give that deeper desire some precedence, some preference, some priority. And so if you go into the kitchen then with that, connected to that deeper desire, then maybe you'll end up doing a fewer things. You'll do, you know, maybe only one thing at a time. You'll eat your breakfast and then you read the paper. You'll only read the paper and eat and not have the radio on. You'll simplify your life. That's one way. Another thing you can do is not do something. It sounds like hopefully this sounds like a very wise thing to do. You know, you pay attention to what you really want and try to follow through on that. Another thing to do is more in terms of an exercise. You can, for a month or for a week, categorically, absolutely not do anything but eat the breakfast. Just this is you can do some exercise. And then after that week, get a sense of how that's changed your life. You feel better by the end of the breakfast. You feel better as you go into your regular day, having done that. Is it beneficial for you to do that? And if you see the benefits of that after a week or after a month, then it might be a lot easier to go to decide on your own then, not just as an act of discipline, but as an act of inspiration, to do that on a regular basis. Good luck. Let us know. Yes.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about walking meditation, because I've heard of it and I don't know if it's the same as sitting that you bring the same awareness and mindfulness to walking
meditation. Yeah. Walking meditation is a very nice practice in terms of, just in and of itself. But it's also nice because it's closer to our normal everyday activity than sitting, you know, quietly with our eyes closed. So it bridges meditation practice into our normal life in a nice way. So mindfulness can be done in any activity at all. There's no, you know, inherent specialness about sitting cross-legged on the floor or sitting in a chair. It can be done in any activity at all. However, there are two primary activities which are offered as being pragmatically very useful for strengthening our ability to be mindful and for getting deeply in touch with ourselves and with the world around us. And one is sitting meditation and the other is walking meditation. And if you go on retreats, like a one-day retreat or however long, we alternate actually between sitting and walking sessions. Half an hour or 45 minutes or an hour of each of one, and then the same length of time of the other, going back and forth. And most people, when they practice at home, mostly do the sitting practice, but some people find it works better for them to do walking meditation rather than sitting meditation. And that's their primary meditation they do at home. In doing walking meditation, you establish a walkway that's about 20 or 30 feet long, and you simply walk back and forth. And initially you find a speed, a pace, that brings you a sense of ease as you walk. It's very important to kind of find a sense of ease, you know, roughly, as you kind of a pace, walking back and forth. Most people can find a pace of ease because I think that, you know, if we go for anger, we go for a walk, you know, it kind of cools us down. You find some pace that brings you some sense of ease. And then from that pace, then we drop our attention down into our feet and our lower legs. And we pay attention to the rhythm of the sensations in our feet and our lower legs as we walk. Just as in the primary place, the primary anchor for mindfulness and sitting practice is the breath, the primary anchor for walking meditation is the rhythmical sensations in the feet. And usually we pay attention to the foot that's doing the stepping. So if you're walking kind of slow, you feel lifting and the placing, the lifting and the placing. If you're walking kind of fast, and maybe all you're aware of is the contact, but you're aware of the sensations involved, the pressure, the contact of the legs kind of tightening up to lift and then lifting up through the air and moving through the air and the release and the lowering and the touching of the and just going, and just let the attention rest there. And the same thing will happen in walking as in sitting. The mind will wander away. And you notice that and you come back to your feet. You come back to your feet. And with time, the mind will become, centered enough to stay present for what's going on in the feet. It seems much less spiritual, the feet, than the breath. And so people say, well, you know, what good is this? You know, it's just my feet after all. But, you know, the breath, you know. But in mindfulness, it's just something else. Mindfulness doesn't have any particular need for a special object. It just, because the object is not the point. The point is strengthening the mindfulness itself. And so we walk back and forth in this 30, 40 foot walkway. And it can be helpful as we walk to label each step very gently in the kind of softest layer of whispering in the back of your mind you have. Just say, you know, each step, stepping, stepping, or perhaps left, right, left, right. Just something to encourage your mind to stay present for the stepping, just like we do the same for the breathing, rising, falling, or in or out. Just walk in any posture, you know, stand up straight, but your hands can be in any posture, in your pockets or behind your back or any ways you want. Sometimes if the mind gets really out of hand and you find yourself really lost in your thoughts or in something, then you can just come to a full stop. Just stop in your tracks and take stock and just be mindful of what's happening, of your thoughts and your feelings, just like you would pay attention to something in your sitting practice, stop and pay attention to that in your walking. Just, and when it's passed and no longer needs acknowledgement, is no longer predominant, then continue with the walking. And you might sometimes stand there for 5 minutes, you know, if it's something's really strong and emotion comes up and it's really powerful. Just stand there and do mindfulness of the emotion if it's there. And it can be as long, it can be half an hour, as long as you're sitting. It's very useful for some people to do walking, even 10 minutes of walking meditation before you do your sitting practice in the morning. And especially if you're the kind of person who wakes up and you're a little bit groggy or tired. Do walking meditation before you sit, and you kind of get your juices going, as they say. And for that purpose, you can actually walk quite fast if that's what you're trying to get energy. And my teacher in Burma, he power walked when he did his walking meditation, and he, you know, he's almost like he was running. And so you can walk quite fast, but the idea is to be mindful. You just be aware of, you know, be aware of the contact, you know, aware of what's happening in your feet as you walk. So that's kind of a, in short. Yeah.
I have a question about walking meditation. I find that, well, in some ways, the sensations are more powerful. They're more obvious in some ways than the breath for me. But at the same time, because they're stronger sensations, I find that I can sort of half pay attention to them. That my mind sort of splits itself somehow and sort of half pays attention to the walking and half just, I don't know, goes into this dull state. And, I don't know what to do with that dullness. It's not thinking, it's just dull.
Well, a few things. One is to use that as a cue that you're not fully present. And then with that cue, with that as a reminder, then find out what it's like to kind of apply yourself, surrender yourself, open yourself more fully to the steps, be more intimate with the feet as they walk. What you're describing is it happens easily when the practice becomes mechanical, which can, you know, either with the breath or with the feet, anything you do kind of in a rhythmic way, it can become mechanical. You're kind of half there, but you're really off drifting off in thoughts. You have to be very attentive that the practice feels organic, feels alive and not mechanical. So if it starts feeling mechanical or dull or distant, then see if there's some way you can revitalize the practice by entering into it more fully. If you can't in some simple way, then the dullness or the mechanicalness, the numbness that might have set in, maybe that should be your focus of attention. And explore that. Forget about the feet. Stop walking. And become a connoisseur of what numbness feels like, what dullness feels like. Where is it in the body? Well, it's mostly in the head, perhaps. Where in the head? Well, it's mostly kind of around the eyes. Where in the eyes? Well, it's mostly kind of this heaviness over the eyelid. And what does it feel like actually there? Well, if you feel it really carefully, it's kind of like, it's actually a very thin film of heaviness. But if I feel it really carefully, it's actually, you know, has this little line. It's not so, it's kind of sharp, you know, the borders of it. And before you know it, you know, you're very present. And the numbness, the dullness has vanished. So, good luck. I like to think of synonyms for mindfulness. As we try to bring mindfulness into our normal life, the word mindfulness sometimes gets in the way. It can seem maybe a little bit too much like you're the observer. And I'm trying to be mindful of this situation by observing it or something. And in a lot of situations, that's what's called for, is to be more attentive and observing. But in some situations, I think the synonyms were kind of better descriptions of the practice. And one synonym I like is intimacy. So in some situations, the question is not how to be more mindful, but how to become more intimate in the situation. You know, you're there with your lover, you know, and or just a minute while I become more mindful. I don't know if that works so well. Maybe it does, but you know, Or another synonym I like is how do you participate more fully with the situation? It's less dualistic then. You're kind of participating in a situation. It's like washing the dishes. You know, rather than being mindful of the dishes, which is, you know, the great thing to do, what would it be like if you really participate wholeheartedly in the activity of washing dishes? And the becoming conscious comes out of being wholeheartedly participatory in the activity. So participating, intimacy, being mindful, I don't know. What other synonyms can you think of?
Embracing.
Embracing in some situations.
Being present.
Being present. Presence. Bringing presence.
Attentive.
I like the word attentive a lot. Attend and attentive, because it's like attending is like nursing or caring, to attend, to care for.
I heard one of those difficult words, have dinner with.
Have dinner?
Have dinner with your emotions.
Have tea with it. As opposed to?
As opposed to fighting it.
Locking the door and stay out. Gary Snyder writes, all of us are apprenticed to the same teacher that the religious institutions originally worked with, reality. Reality insight says, master the 24 hours. Do it well without self-pity. It is as hard to get the children herded into the carpool and down the road to the bus as it is to chant sutras in the Buddha hall on a cold morning in the monastery. One move is not better than the other. Each can be quite boring, and they both have the virtuous quality of repetition. Repetition and ritual and their good results come in many forms. Changing the filter, wiping noses, going to meetings, picking up around the house, washing dishes, checking the dipstick. Don't let yourself think that these are distracting you from the more serious pursuits. Such a round of chores is not a set of difficulties we hope to escape from, so that we may do our, quote, practice, which will put us on a, quote, path. It is our path. So be mindful is to be mindful of our life as it is, not to avoid it, to do something that seems really spiritual. I'll read two more and then we can sit. Just because I like them. How can you be humble if you're always paying attention to yourself? If you were truly humble, you would not bother about yourself at all. Why should you? A humble person can do great things with an uncommon perfection, because he or she is no longer concerned about incidentals, like his or her own interests or reputation, and therefore is no longer needs to waste effort defending them. The huge difference between becoming conscious and becoming self-conscious. And people who do mindfulness practice should hopefully notice the difference between being mindful and self-conscious. Many people confuse the two, and then they become more and more self-conscious, and then all kinds of stress arises because of that. Because self-consciousness comes with judgment, you know, kind of self-worry, self-concern, self-preoccupation. Conscious, but not self-conscious. I will not die an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance, to live so that which came to me as a seed goes to the next as a blossom, goes on as a fruit. So let's sit and inhabit our life for a few minutes here. Taking a deep breath, and as you breathe out, surrender to the present, to now, as it is. So that brings, this brings to end the 5-week introductory course. We're going to do this again. I think the next one starts May 1st. So in May, if any of you want to do it again or know someone wants to do it. What's going to happen between now and then is that we're going to continue with have our regular Thursday evening sessions. And in some sense, the next few weeks will be a continuation of the 5-week introductory course. We'll just have, it'll be the 6th week and the 7th week. I'll just kind of talk on subjects which kind of build on what we've done so far. So some of you might want to come back. But the schedule changes. What happens is we come and we sit, first thing at 7, we sit for half an hour. And then there's 45 minutes of a talk and discussion. And then we end with 15 minutes of sitting. So it's different than this class where it's mostly been talk and it's very little sitting. So so you're welcome to come, and I try to make lots of time for discussion or questions during the Thursday evening classes, so that those of you who are beginning to meditate, or those of you meditating for some time, if you have any kinds of questions about the practice, please come, and that's a good time to ask questions and whatever you want to ask. Periodically, we do one-day retreats here in Palo Alto, over there at the Unitarian Church, usually. And if some of you, after some time, you've sat for a couple of months, you want to try a one-day retreat, it can be quite nice to sit for a whole day, or if you think a whole day is too much, come for half the day. Come for the morning probably is best. And if you see in our newsletter that we have out there, we do two kinds of one-day sittings, kinds that have instructions and kinds that have don't have instructions. And if you're new, if you've never been to a one-day sitting, probably you want to come to the kind where there's instructions the first time you come. And otherwise, and I don't say much about the Dana, about donations. I said something at the beginning, maybe it's nice to say something at the end. So these kinds of classes here are offered on a donation basis. We really want to make them available to people as freely as we can, so anybody can come regardless of your means, and that money is not an issue. However, there are two baskets out in the hallway, and one of them says rent on it, and that is to help pay for the rent. We pay the friends for use of this room. And if everybody did a dollar, that'd be more than cover what we give the friends. And the other basket is for the teacher, and usually that's me. Sometimes we have guests. And this is how I support myself, or how I... Maybe that's not the right word. I don't know what the right word is. Because I'm not doing it. I can't say I'm supporting myself. But this is the way that I'm supported. is through this very strange system in America. It must be very strange, just by whatever donations people give me. I think 95% of my livelihood comes from donations. So it's just kind of on trust, and you know, I think it's best in this system of donations we have here, is not to think of it as an exchange. But if you're inspired to support the teachings, the Dharma, the practice, and allow it to be possible to keep teaching it and keep supporting other people to practice, then make a donation if you feel inspired. Otherwise, save it for something else that inspires you. So thank you all.